Nothing like day baseball, no question about that. Well, we teased it earlier, but later on this evening, 7 to 8 o'clock tonight, you'll be at the Baseball Heritage Museum, and you are going to give a presentation on the Cactus League and the integration of spring training. What all is involved in your presentation tonight?
Well, I have to start off by saying I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for Larry Doby. And, you know, we're here in Cleveland celebrating Larry Doby's legacy all this month. Last night I was at the game as well, and I went and stood outside the ballpark and took some pictures of Larry Doby's statue. And it just gives me chills thinking about Larry Doby and his career. He's a sometimes overlooked pioneer. You know, Robinson got a lot of credit, of course, Jackie Robinson, for being the first African-American player in the major leagues, but everything that Jackie Robinson experienced, Larry Doby did as well. And so we're going to talk about his role. You know, when Larry Doby broke in with Cleveland, he joined the team in the middle of the 47 season. And so 1948 would have been his first spring training with the team, which took place out in Tucson, Arizona. And Tucson, Arizona had never seen a black major league player before Larry Doby showed up. And we're going to talk about tonight what that meant and how Larry Doby and some of the other players in the early years of the Cactus League out there, spring training had only begun 1 year earlier. Bill Veeck, who owned the Indians back then, was the man, one of the two men who brought spring training baseball to Arizona. So consequently, Larry Doby and then the New York Giants, Horace Stoneham, the early players on that team, including Willie Mays and Monty Irvin, these guys were the first guys to show up for spring training in Arizona, and they really forced the integration of all sorts of institutions outside of baseball just by their mere presence.
Really incredible when you take a look back 70 years ago. Jackie Robinson breaks Major League Baseball's color barrier. Spring training begins with the Cactus League in Arizona. It's interesting how those two events are connected, because I think you really have to go back and look into the archives to see how they're connected, and I'm sure that'll be a lot of what's discussed in the presentation tonight. You've mentioned that there are four pioneering African-American players who were inducted into the Cactus League Hall of Fame this past spring. If you can, kind of elaborate on those four and tell us why they were so important to this process.
Yeah, you know, and that's a great observation you made about the connectedness of these two things. The idea that spring training baseball had found its way to Arizona at the exact same time that integration had found its way to Major League Baseball is really no coincidence. This is very representative of the direction that the game was moving in figurative and literal ways. You know, you've got westward expansion. The game is moving out there. Here, the New York Giants were one of the first teams to go to Arizona, along with Veeck's Indians. And, you know, obviously, 10 years later, Horace Stoneham is going to move his whole team to San Francisco. You know, at the same time, baseball is moving into a modern era regarding the inclusion of black ballplayers. And so this convergence of things that was happening out there, it's a watershed moment in baseball history. Right after Doby in 48, you have Monty Irvin shows up in 51, and then Willie Mays in 52, and then Ernie Banks in 53. They were in Phoenix, they were in Mesa, and they were in Tucson. And this is the beginning of spring training baseball out there. It was just first the Indians and the Giants, then the Cubs joined. And the fourth team was actually the Baltimore Orioles, where I live in Baltimore, when the league officially became a league and had enough teams to be considered a league. Ask me again what you were starting off with that question.
We went a few different directions with that question. I mean, I think it's interesting because the presentation you're giving, I think it kind of opens itself up to a big discussion. I think with the folks who attend this tonight, that's kind of what you're going for as well, right? You're going to have a lot of people there who are learning a lot of these things for the first time. And I think part of what you want to hit on also is the idea that these players, really kind of crossover players, many of them from the Negro Leagues, they were also seen as forerunners in the Civil Rights Movement. And that really kind of shows that those guys were much, much bigger than just baseball, correct?
Yes. Let me give you a little for example. So Larry Doby shows up in Tucson, and this is a big deal, of course. Well, he can't even stay at the same hotel with the rest of the team. That had not been figured out yet. He shows up, and they just kind of turn him down at the desk. And he didn't realize that that was the situation. So he ends up in a house with a black family in Tucson, in a neighborhood, the small enclave where the few African Americans in town happen to live. But slowly but surely, these institutions start to bend and realize that they need to kind of get up with the times here. And this is 20 years in advance of the Civil Rights Movement. This is 20 years before 1967. So, and 64, let's say. So not quite 20, but still. The idea is they realize it's time to get with it. They're going to lose business, and let's not kid ourselves, because that's the number one motivation. It wasn't any kind of altruistic, philosophies that made hotels and bars and restaurants start to allow African Americans. They realized they were going to lose money. They realized that the team was going to pull out of the hotel if they didn't make room for Larry Doby eventually. And the same thing happened with Willie Mays and Monty Irvin in Phoenix. They were living in private residences as well. They were not allowed to stay in the hotel. Ernie Banks and Mesa, same thing. But then finally it starts to break down. Somewhere in the early to mid-50s is when you start to see the hotels start allowing the players to stay, the restaurants and the bars starting to allow the guys to come in. And it was really a business decision.
Again, we're talking with Charlie Vassalero here. He's going to be giving a presentation at the Baseball Heritage Museum a little bit later on tonight. You can catch him down there at 7. Well, and I know in your research on this topic, too, you've conducted an extensive amount of it so far, talking about some of the formative years and really kind of the living conditions. You know, you had these four individuals that you mentioned. They were in these neighborhoods where, you know, a lot of times the accommodations weren't great. And I know you've actually got some photographs and you've really well documented some of these conditions that these guys were in. If you can, kind of just elaborate on that and give us an idea as to what those accommodations were like.
Well, this was fascinating and fantastic to uncover. I met with a writer in Tucson who wrote a history of Tucson book, and kind of cold called him and asked him if he'd help me with some research. So we went to the Tucson Historical Society and we looked up the address of the home where Larry Doby lived. And we go to this house, and there's a family living in there, a couple is living in this house, and they see us kind of nosing around out in front of the house, and they're wondering what we're doing, and they come out, and I said, I'm sorry, don't mean to be intruding on your residence here, but we're just conducting some research in front of your house, and I don't know if you know, but Larry Doby, the first African-American player in the American League, used to live in the house. Well, the guy ends up being a baseball fan, and he's like, really? And I said, yeah, and Satchel Paige lived here, too. And he was just ecstatic, and he invites us in. We take a bunch of pictures of his house, and, from the stories that I read in the history books, Doby and Satchel Paige, when they would come to this house and stay there, you know, the day games, we're talking about day games, it's a spring training day game, so afterwards, they're just sitting out on the front, and there's a nice little deck out front or a patio or a porch, and they're drinking beer after the game, and the people in the neighborhood would just come by and sit down, and of course, it's Satchel Paige as well, who's going to regale them with stories, and this is what happened there. So some of this is I would call also the positive side of a kind of negative story. You know, here they're still being segregated against, but for the lucky people who were in this community, they're getting to hang out with Larry Doby and Satchel Paige, and Doby and Paige are making new friends that they'll never forget in these places. In Phoenix, where Willie Mays lived, I found the address to that house. And it was listed, there was a club, there was an Elks Club next to it, which was the African-American Elks Club in Phoenix at the time. And travelers, there was a book called The Green Book, which was a book that let African-American people know which places were going to be friendly and accommodating to them. And I actually found the address of this Elks Club in something called The Green Book, the 1950 edition of The Green Book. And that's how I found my way to the house where Willie Mays used to live.
Wow, just incredible stuff. Boy, those stories, they really kind of give you a pretty good idea as to how baseball really has this powerful connection to keep us all connected. And really, in many ways, even back then, when segregation was a big issue, even back then, it still brought a lot of people together.
Yeah, it's amazing. And some of those guys that Saw Mays when he was a kid. They're still there. I went to the Elks Club, and these old dudes are still hanging out there that knew Mays when they were all kids. And I say kids, everybody was in their 20s. So Mays is in his 20s, and these guys are in their 20s, and he's coming around to the Elks Club to drink beer with them. Mays wasn't really a drinker. Mays drank Coca-Cola. But he was still hanging around at the club with these guys. And even in the years after the hotel became integrated, he still chose to live in that house because he had made so many friends in the neighborhood.
Wow, very, very cool stuff. Well, Charlie, before we cut you loose here, I want to give you a chance to plug your program coming up tonight again, 7 to 8 o'clock. It's at the Baseball Heritage Museum. Tell us all about it.
Yeah, if people out there have never been to the Baseball Heritage Museum, what a jewel this place is. I only discovered it in last October. I was in town for the World Series, and in the morning I had a little time on my hands, and I heard about this place, the Baseball Heritage Museum, on the site of the original League Park, which the ball field is still in its original footprint over there. Babe Ruth hit his 500th home run at that field, and about 48 others as well, if I'm not mistaken. A pretty high number of his home runs were hit there. The right field line was about 290. And so the museum is the old ticket office. If you were buying tickets to go to a game at League Park, that building is still intact, and that's where we're going to be. They've got a great collection of Cleveland baseball memorabilia, things relative to the old Indians and even the Negro Leagues, Cleveland Buckeyes and Spiders teams that were there as well. And it's just a great setting to have this conversation in. We'll be there for about an hour. I'm sure there'll be a little time afterwards to hang out and talk, I would hope. If people come out to the presentation, we could kind of continue the conversation afterwards as well.
Very cool stuff. And again, it's 100% free. It's open to the public. It begins at 7 o'clock tonight at the Baseball Heritage Museum. Charlie, this was a lot of fun. We certainly appreciate you making some time for us. Enjoy your stay in Cleveland, and we look forward to hearing that talk a little bit later on tonight.
Thank you as well, Andy, and thanks for taking the time from me.
Absolutely. We certainly appreciate you coming on the show. We need to take a break. We are very late for one. We'll do that right now. Coming up in a couple of minutes, we'll get to Your Money Now and then Cindy Breida with the local news as we enter the final hour of Bullseye on the Afternoon on AM 930 WEOL.